This is the Pearson EdExcel International GCSE English as a Second Language, Paper 2, Listening Test, January 2020. This test is in four parts, and you will have to answer questions on what you hear. At the end of each extract, there will be a pause to give you time to read the questions. You will hear all four parts twice. Write your answers in the spaces in your question booklet as you listen.
Part 1, Section A. In this section, you will hear five short extracts in which people are talking about subjects studied at school. Read the list of subjects below, then listen to the extracts. For each question 1 to 5, identify which subject A to H is being described by each speaker by putting a cross for the correct answer. If you change your mind about an answer, put a line through the box and then mark your new answer with a cross. Not all subjects are described, and each subject may be used more than once. One mark will be awarded for each correct answer.
You have 1 minute to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions.
Speaker 1.
It is the most widely spoken language in the world and the third most common mother tongue. Great writers, classic and modern, have written in this language. It is important we do well in the subject, as we must have a good grade in it if we want to go to university.
Speaker 2. We study the physical features of the Earth and its atmosphere. We learn about human activities, both positive and negative, and discuss how they affect the Earth's environment and what we can do to help the planet. We also study how changing conditions on Earth have affected and still affect its inhabitants, both human and animal. Speaker 3.
In this subject, we study the past events of a particular people or country. We discuss what happened at a certain point in time, what were the effects, and whether they have affected us many years into the future. This is an interesting subject, as it can help us to understand our society today.
Speaker 4.
We study how solids, liquids, and gases are created, changed, and even destroyed. We do practical experiments to record these changes. The most important thing we need to learn by heart is the periodic table. It shows us all the known elements in the universe, and each one has its own code in the form of a letter.
Speaker 5.
Although some of it can be very difficult, it is a very practical subject. It can help us in everyday activities such as using addition and subtraction to calculate how much money we need for our shopping. We learn to solve problems, both simple and complex. There are three parts to this subject: arithmetic, geometry, and algebra.
Now listen a second time and check your answers.
Speaker 1.
It is the most widely spoken language in the world and the third most common mother tongue. Great writers, classic and modern, have written in this language. It is important we do well in the subject, as we must have a good grade in it if we want to go to university.
Speaker 2. We study the physical features of the Earth and its atmosphere. We learn about human activities, both positive and negative, and discuss how they affect the Earth's environment and what we can do to help the planet. We also study how changing conditions on Earth have affected and still affect its inhabitants, both human and animal. Speaker 3.
In this subject, we study the past events of a particular people or country. We discuss what happened at a certain point in time, what were the effects, and whether they have affected us many years into the future. This is an interesting subject, as it can help us to understand our society today.
Speaker 4.
We study how solids, liquids, and gases are created, changed, and even destroyed. We do practical experiments to record these changes. The most important thing we need to learn by heart is the periodic table. It shows us all the known elements in the universe, and each one has its own code in the form of a letter.
Speaker 5.
Although some of it can be very difficult, it is a very practical subject. It can help us in everyday activities such as using addition and subtraction to calculate how much money we need for our shopping. We learn to solve problems, both simple and complex. There are three parts to this subject: arithmetic, geometry, and algebra.
That's the end of Part 1, Section A. Now turn to Part 1, Section B.
Section B. In this section, you will hear a short talk about school holidays. For questions 6 to 10, listen and answer the questions below. Write no more than 3 words for each answer. 1 mark will be awarded for each correct answer.
You have 1 minute to read the questions.
Now listen and answer the questions.
As the country's primary and secondary schools return for the autumn term, there are those who argue that the summer holidays have been too long, and it would be less stressful for many if we cut back on their length. Working parents have to rely on a variety of plans to cover the holiday period, often including costly childcare, help from relatives, and a range of planned activities. Many people think that long summer holidays link back to the Victorian era, when children were needed to help their parents on the family farm during the summer months. On the other hand, some people believe that the long summer holidays were really a consequence of the increasingly successful fight by the trade unions for more time off for workers. The development of the railways boosted the family holiday by the seaside, and in Britain, that meant the summer months. A survey of countries worldwide reveals a similar pattern to Britain, with most having long school breaks at some point in the year. Head teachers argue that both teachers and children benefit from long holidays.
For exhausted teachers, this is a time for them to prepare for the new academic year and to recharge their batteries. Children have experiences over the summer, which develop their own ways to fill the time, often engaging in new activities and interests. Holidays provide an opportunity to develop their social and communication skills outside of the school environment. Some think the United States have solved the problem of long school holidays, where summer camps provide a home from home and a chance for children to develop their confidence and learn new skills. In Britain, there are similar organisations, but these are costly. Without some support, less privileged, poorer children would miss out. If we are to follow this route, who pays? For the time being, there remains the problem of how can our youngsters be safely, productively, and affordably entertained throughout the long summer holiday.
Now listen a second time and check your answers.
As the country's primary and secondary schools return for the autumn term, there are those who argue that the summer holidays have been too long, and it would be less stressful for many if we cut back on their length. Working parents have to rely on a variety of plans to cover the holiday period, often including costly childcare, help from relatives, and a range of planned activities. Many people think that long summer holidays link back to the Victorian era, when children were needed to help their parents on the family farm during the summer months. On the other hand, some people believe that the long summer holidays were really a consequence of the increasingly successful fight by the trade unions for more time off for workers. The development of the railways boosted the family holiday by the seaside, and in Britain, that meant the summer months. A survey of countries worldwide reveals a similar pattern to Britain, with most having long school breaks at some point in the year. Head teachers argue that both teachers and children benefit from long holidays. For exhausted teachers, this is a time for them to prepare for the new academic year and to recharge their batteries. Children have experiences over the summer, which develop their own ways to fill the time, often engaging in new activities and interests. Holidays provide an opportunity to develop their social and communication skills outside of the school environment. Some think the United States have solved the problem of long school holidays, where summer camps provide a home from home and a chance for children to develop their confidence and learn new skills. In Britain, there are similar organisations, but these are costly. Without some support, less privileged, poorer children would miss out. If we are to follow this route, who pays? For the time being, there remains the problem of how can our youngsters be safely, productively, and affordably entertained throughout the long summer holiday.
That's the end of Part 1, Section B. Now turn to Part 2.
Part 2. In this part, you will hear a journalist, Joanna Brown, talking about fruit and vegetables. For questions 11 to 18, listen and complete the notes. Write no more than 3 words for each answer. Questions 19 and 20 must be answered with a cross in a box. If you change your mind about an answer, put a line through the box and then mark your new answer with a cross. 1 mark will be awarded for each correct answer.
You have 1 minute to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions.
Hi, I'm Joanna Brown. I've written about food and issues surrounding its production and consumption for 25 years. I regularly contribute to various radio and television programmes on which I've campaigned for greater awareness of the food industry. Almost 50% of the fruit and vegetables which farmers grow don't make it to the shelves of our supermarkets. Whether the fruit or vegetable has a lump, a slightly irregular shape, or there is a variation in colour or texture, it is rejected. Imperfect fruit and vegetables do not conform to our large retailers' requirements for perfect-looking produce. Behind the scenes of large-scale, intensive horticulture, a number of techniques are used to deliver the type of produce supermarkets favour. These include using chemicals to control growth and pesticides that get rid of most of the natural colour variation in the crop. Modern seed varieties are selected for their ability to produce visually pleasing and identical specimens that will have a long shelf life in the store, even if their flavour is poor. About 3 years ago, a number of celebrity chefs highlighted this appalling food waste, saying it was a scandal. A year later, the chairman of the government's Environment, Food and Rural Affairs Committee criticised supermarkets for not selling enough wonky or misshaped vegetables and fruit. Wonky has now become the term used to describe the 4 out of every 10 vegetables and fruit that are considered substandard by retailers because they do not fit their fussy requirements. It's ridiculous that perfectly good vegetables are wasted simply because they are a funny shape. Knobbly carrots and parsnips do not cook or taste any different, or, more importantly, any worse, remarked the chairman. Supermarkets have responded to his criticism and are now offering a few limited lines of fruit and vegetables labelled imperfect picks, or perfectly imperfect, or even beautiful on the inside, for a much lower price compared to the immaculately groomed norm that dominates their fresh produce shelves. There are a number of independent food producers who have started schemes to sell wonky organic and seasonal fruit and vegetables via online shopping and local distribution. Some are trialling and testing seeds to find the most flavoursome varieties. These entrepreneurs are, however, up against the giants who produce food on an industrial scale. And let's face it, a box of organically produced fruit and vegetables is not cheap. It's also crazy that food banks, created to help people in need, have to hand out tinned and packaged food when so much fresh produce is being wasted. Environmentally, it is destructive as well, because significant energy and resources are poured into growing fruit and vegetables, only for them to rot in landfill, where they give off climate warming gases. These rejected specimens, on account of their colour or shape, may not be the prettiest to look at, but beauty, as they say, is in the eye of the beholder. That is why I have great trouble with the word wonky, because it implies that the identical fruit that supermarkets prefer represents the pick of the crop, while wonky is second best. We've been encouraged to expect our fruit and vegetables to look the same without really taking into consideration what growers do to achieve these beautiful-looking results. Anyone who grows their own knows that they hardly ever look like supermarket specimens, but as allotment holders and gardeners frequently testify, they invariably taste better. It's time for us to rethink our idea of what naturally grown produce really looks like. If we want to stop waste, as well as eat fruit and vegetables that have been cultivated for flavour, not looks, wonky must become the new accepted normal.
Now listen a second time and check your answers.
Hi, I'm Joanna Brown. I've written about food and issues surrounding its production and consumption for 25 years. I regularly contribute to various radio and television programmes on which I've campaigned for greater awareness of the food industry. Almost 50% of the fruit and vegetables which farmers grow don't make it to the shelves of our supermarkets. Whether the fruit or vegetable has a lump, a slightly irregular shape, or there is a variation in colour or texture, it is rejected. Imperfect fruit and vegetables do not conform to our large retailers' requirements for perfect-looking produce. Behind the scenes of large-scale, intensive horticulture, a number of techniques are used to deliver the type of produce supermarkets favour. These include using chemicals to control growth and pesticides that get rid of most of the natural colour variation in the crop. Modern seed varieties are selected for their ability to produce visually pleasing and identical specimens that will have a long shelf life in the store, even if their flavour is poor. About 3 years ago, a number of celebrity chefs highlighted this appalling food waste, saying it was a scandal. A year later, the chairman of the government's Environment, Food and Rural Affairs Committee criticised supermarkets for not selling enough wonky or misshaped vegetables and fruit. Wonky has now become the term used to describe the 4 out of every 10 vegetables and fruit that are considered substandard by retailers because they do not fit their fussy requirements. It's ridiculous that perfectly good vegetables are wasted simply because they are a funny shape. Knobbly carrots and parsnips do not cook or taste any different, or, more importantly, any worse, remarked the chairman. Supermarkets have responded to his criticism and are now offering a few limited lines of fruit and vegetables labelled imperfect picks, or perfectly imperfect, or even beautiful on the inside, for a much lower price compared to the immaculately groomed norm that dominates their fresh produce shelves. There are a number of independent food producers who have started schemes to sell wonky organic and seasonal fruit and vegetables via online shopping and local distribution. Some are trialling and testing seeds to find the most flavoursome varieties. These entrepreneurs are, however, up against the giants who produce food on an industrial scale. And let's face it, a box of organically produced fruit and vegetables is not cheap. It's also crazy that food banks, created to help people in need, have to hand out tinned and packaged food when so much fresh produce is being wasted. Environmentally, it is destructive as well, because significant energy and resources are poured into growing fruit and vegetables, only for them to rot in landfill, where they give off climate-warming gases. These rejected specimens, on account of their colour or shape, may not be the prettiest to look at, but beauty, as they say, is in the eye of the beholder. That is why I have great trouble with the word wonky, because it implies that the identical fruit that supermarkets prefer represents the pick of the crop, while wonky is second best. We've been encouraged to expect our fruit and vegetables to look the same without really taking into consideration what growers do to achieve these beautiful-looking results. Anyone who grows their own knows that they hardly ever look like supermarket specimens, but as allotment holders and gardeners frequently testify, they invariably taste better. It's time for us to rethink our idea of what naturally grown produce really looks like. If we want to stop waste, as well as eat fruit and vegetables that have been cultivated for flavour, not looks, wonky must become the new accepted normal.
That's the end of part two. Now turn to part three.
Part three. In this part, you will hear a discussion about school uniform. For questions 21 to 25, listen and answer the questions. You do not need to write in full sentences. Questions 26 to 30 must be answered with a cross in a box. If you change your mind about an answer, put a line through the box and then mark your new answer with a cross. One mark will be awarded for each correct answer.
You have 1 minute to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions.
I would like to introduce to the school council Chloe, who is the new representative for year 12. Let's give her a warm welcome. There are a number of issues we would like to discuss, and I would like Chloe to open the meeting.
Thank you, sir. I've been asked by my colleagues on the school council to discuss the issue of school uniform. There have been suggestions, particularly from the younger students, that uniforms should be abolished. You might not like your school uniform, but I think it's here to stay for a good reason. A shirt, tie, and blazer may not be the ingredients for my favourite outfit, but if I were given the choice, I wouldn't throw away the idea of a school uniform. Wearing a uniform is a badge of pride. It helps create an identity for a school and is an important part of being a school student.
As head teacher of this school, I agree wholeheartedly with Chloe. A formal school uniform shows that you are part of an organisation. Wearing it says that we are all in this together, teaching and learning. Also, if you wear a uniform, it is a sign of respect and feeling proud of being part of an organisation. Uniforms give students a sense of belonging to a particular school and create a sense of identity for the school in the wider community.
Our school is one of many that seems to be reverting to a more formal uniform. This September, I'll be wearing a blazer instead of my old jumper and polo shirt. A number of students have complained, but the general opinion in Year 12 is that the old jumpers and polos were childish and after a while looked untidy and scruffy.
You're quite right, Chloe. School uniform teaches students to dress smartly and to take pride in their appearance. It helps students to prepare for when they leave school and may have to dress smartly or wear a uniform in the world of work. As a teacher, as well as the head teacher, I firmly believe that a school uniform can improve learning by reducing distraction, sharpening focus on schoolwork, and making the classroom a more serious environment, allowing students to perform better academically.
Perhaps most importantly, a uniform means that students don't have to worry about peer pressure when it comes to their clothes. When everyone is dressed the same, worrying about how you look isn't so important. There's no competition about being dressed in the latest trend, which would put a great deal of financial pressure on students and particularly their parents. I agree that having a uniform improves behaviour and increases achievement in a school. A strict uniform gives the impression that rules are strict too, perhaps helping maintain a sense of order at school.
Although wearing a school uniform is less expensive than buying a whole wardrobe of outfits, a uniform can still be pricey. Many schools have a specific supplier, and wearing cheaper alternatives can result in punishment if the black trousers you're wearing aren't exactly the right kind of black trousers. Finding a uniform that fits you, especially if you're limited to one shop, can also be a struggle. If, like me, for example, you're very tall, you can have problems.
Recently, there was a high-level discussion about the cost of a school uniform across the country. New guidance was issued to end the practice of a single uniform supplier, enabling parents to use different uniform suppliers. If a school decides to change their uniform, for example, a new emblem or colour, changes should be restricted to one or two items, preferably with sewn-on logos. Changing from a one-supplier system could help families with the cost of school uniform.
Although it might seem a shame to miss out on those 2 years in the sixth form of dressing as I like at school, I welcome the smart dress code. Not only does it make getting dressed each morning a lot easier, but it sets our sixth formers up as role models for the younger students, and that's important. Has anyone else anything to say?
My sister's a Year 8 student, and she likes uniforms because everyone is the same, and no one can be left out by the way they're dressed. She thinks our school uniform looks very smart. The uniform might not be what she wears in her own time, but it gives her a sense of belonging and takes away the pressure of what to wear. She agrees school uniform is not fashionable, but that's exactly why she thinks it should stay. I think she has a point.
Thank you. We can report back to both the school and the governors, informing them that the decision to keep school uniform is unanimous. We will include this in the latest newsletter and announce it at our next assembly. Shall we move on to the next item on our agenda?
Now listen a second time and check your answers.
I would like to introduce to the school council Chloe, who is the new representative for Year 12. Let's give her a warm welcome. There are a number of issues we would like to discuss, and I would like Chloe to open the meeting.
Thank you, sir. I've been asked by my colleagues on the school council to discuss the issue of school uniform. There have been suggestions, particularly from the younger students, that uniforms should be abolished. You might not like your school uniform, but I think it's here to stay for a good reason. A shirt, tie, and blazer may not be the ingredients for my favourite outfit, but if I were given the choice, I wouldn't throw away the idea of a school uniform. Wearing a uniform is a badge of pride. It helps create an identity for a school and is an important part of being a school student.
As head teacher of this school, I agree wholeheartedly with Chloe. A formal school uniform shows that you are part of an organisation. Wearing it says that we are all in this together, teaching and learning. Also, if you wear a uniform, it is a sign of respect and feeling proud of being part of an organisation. Uniforms give students a sense of belonging to a particular school and create a sense of identity for the school in the wider community.
Our school is one of many that seems to be reverting to a more formal uniform. This September, I'll be wearing a blazer instead of my old jumper and polo shirt. A number of students have complained, but the general opinion in Year 12 is that the old jumpers and polos were childish and after a while looked untidy and scruffy.
You're quite right, Chloe. School uniform teaches students to dress smartly and to take pride in their appearance. It helps students to prepare for when they leave school and may have to dress smartly or wear a uniform in the world of work. As a teacher, as well as the head teacher, I firmly believe that a school uniform can improve learning by reducing distraction, sharpening focus on schoolwork and making the classroom a more serious environment, allowing students to perform better academically.
Perhaps most importantly, a uniform means that students don't have to worry about peer pressure when it comes to their clothes. When everyone is dressed the same, worrying about how you look isn't so important. There's no competition about being dressed in the latest trend, which would put a great deal of financial pressure on students and particularly their parents. I agree that having a uniform improves behaviour and increases achievement in a school. A strict uniform gives the impression that rules are strict too, perhaps helping maintain a sense of order at school.
Although wearing a school uniform is less expensive than buying a whole wardrobe of outfits, a uniform can still be pricey. Many schools have a specific supplier, and wearing cheaper alternatives can result in punishment if the black trousers you're wearing aren't exactly the right kind of black trousers. Finding a uniform that fits you, especially if you're limited to one shop, can also be a struggle. If, like me, for example, you're very tall, you can have problems.
Recently, there was a high-level discussion about the cost of a school uniform across the country. New guidance was issued to end the practice of a single uniform supplier, enabling parents to use different uniform suppliers. If a school decides to change their uniform, for example, a new emblem or colour, changes should be restricted to one or two items, preferably with sewn-on logos. Changing from a one-supplier system could help families with the cost of school uniform.
Although it might seem a shame to miss out on those 2 years in the sixth form of dressing as I like at school, I welcome the smart dress code. Not only does it make getting dressed each morning a lot easier, but it sets our sixth formers up as role models for the younger students, and that's important. Has anyone else anything to say?
My sister's a Year 8 student, and she likes uniforms because everyone is the same, and no one can be left out by the way they're dressed. She thinks our school uniform looks very smart. The uniform might not be what she wears in her own time, but it gives her a sense of belonging and takes away the pressure of what to wear. She agrees school uniform is not fashionable, but that's exactly why she thinks it should stay. I think she has a point.
Thank you. We can report back to both the school and the governors, informing them that the decision to keep school uniform is unanimous. We will include this in the latest newsletter and announce it at our next assembly. Shall we move on to the next item on our agenda?
That's the end of part 3. Now turn to part 4.
Part 4. In this part, you will hear an extract from a radio programme about Nordic walking. For questions 31 to 33 and 38 to 40, listen and complete the sentences below. Write no more than 3 words for each answer. For questions 34 to 37, complete the table. Write no more than 3 words for each answer. 1 mark will be awarded for each correct answer.
You have 1 minute to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions.
In today's programme, as part of Health Awareness Week, I would like to introduce an activity which is increasing in worldwide popularity. The aim of our programme is to promote a healthy lifestyle without expensive subscriptions to gyms, and to encourage people to spend more time out in the fresh air. This is where Nordic walking comes into its own. It is a total body version of walking that can be enjoyed both by non-athletes as a health-promoting physical activity and by athletes as a sport. It can be done by anybody, anywhere, and does not require expensive equipment or clothing. The activity is performed with specially designed walking poles, similar to ski poles. Nordic walking is an enhancement of ordinary walking, which means it makes something we learn as babies twice as effective. The poles used add two major benefits to ordinary walking. Firstly, the upper body muscles, which are not used in normal walking, have the same physical workout as the legs. Secondly, the poles help to propel walkers along, which means that they work harder than usual. Yet the support given by the poles makes the activity feel easier. Nordic walking is a specific fitness technique, which is not to be confused with trekking, hill walking, or trail running, as the poles are not placed in front of the walker, but to the sides, in a way that increases the use of the upper body. It is the fastest growing fitness activity in the world, and it is highly effective, very affordable, and most of all, an enjoyable and sociable activity. However, the technique must be learned correctly if the participant is to get the most out of the activity, and this is taught by qualified instructors who have undertaken an officially recognized course. The idea of Nordic walking as a sport began when competitive cross-country skiers in Finland started to use ski poles in their off-season training, which included running and walking when there was no snow. They soon realized that the technique was a perfect training aid that kept their hearts and lungs in peak condition, and that upper and lower body muscles remained in top shape. Over the next 50 years, this summer activity began to be used by more people in Finland as a recreational sport, and enthusiasts realized that they were achieving a whole body workout that was simple to incorporate into everyday life. Towards the end of the 20th century, the Finnish Sports Institute joined forces with other agencies and a leading ski pole manufacturer to formalize the technique of the new sport and to develop specific poles for Nordic walkers. Research into the effects of this simple technique soon led to it being trialed as a health and rehabilitation technique. The results were so impressive that it became a major tool in health and wellness programs worldwide. Nordic walking rapidly became a mainstream activity, and there are now well over 10 million regular Nordic walkers globally who enjoy this outdoor activity all year round. A few years ago, the World Nordic Walking Federation was formed to promote safe Nordic walking to communities worldwide whose focus is on accessibility and raising the standards of education of the lead walkers. Conferences have been organized to help bridge the gap between the medical profession and the fitness industry. Specialists are now launching children's fitness courses, which will enable instructors to deliver the technique safely to youngsters. Compared to ordinary walking, Nordic walking involves applying force to the poles with each stride. Thus, the upper and lower body are toned at the same time, and 90% of the skeletal muscles are made to work. The use of poles reduces the pressure and impact on joints and strengthens back and abdominal muscles. The technique helps reduce tensions in the neck and shoulders, while the upper body movement improves posture and the way you walk. This is particularly beneficial to those who have a sedentary lifestyle. It burns up to 46% more calories than ordinary walking. If you would like to lose a few pounds, then Nordic walking is an enjoyable way to do this. It is one of the most effective cross-training techniques for athletes and sports people who require the ultimate cardiovascular and endurance conditioning, as it improves their aerobic capacity and muscular strength in a short period of time. Nordic walking is unique in that it provides benefits for everybody from those with medical problems to the super fit. It is ideal for people who have not exercised for a long time or who dislike traditional sports or gym activities. An injured person can use the poles to support and guide, working to improve fitness as part of their rehabilitation. Athletes can use the technique for cross-country training and can incorporate Nordic walking into their program. Community groups find it a sociable way to keep fit. Whatever your fitness level, age, or goal, this technique is enjoyable for all. The activity can be done anywhere. A street pavement is just as effective a surface as a grassy slope. A sandy beach will provide an excellent opportunity for a full body workout. All you do is adapt the tips of the poles for whatever surface you are walking on. Rubber for hard, smooth surfaces, and a toughened metal tip for trails, beach, and ice. Nordic walking combines exercise with nature, which is thought to boost mood far more effectively than a session in the gym. Hey, try it!
Now listen a second time and check your answers.
In today's program, as part of Health Awareness Week, I would like to introduce an activity which is increasing in worldwide popularity. The aim of our program is to promote a healthy lifestyle without expensive subscriptions to gyms, and to encourage people to spend more time out in the fresh air. This is where Nordic walking comes into its own. It is a total body version of walking that can be enjoyed both by non-athletes as a health-promoting physical activity and by athletes as a sport. It can be done by anybody, anywhere, and does not require expensive equipment or clothing. The activity is performed with specially designed walking poles, similar to ski poles. Nordic walking is an enhancement of ordinary walking, which means it makes something we learn as babies twice as effective. The poles used add two major benefits to ordinary walking. Firstly, the upper body muscles, which are not used in normal walking, have the same physical workout as the legs. Secondly, the poles help to propel walkers along, which means that they work harder than usual. Yet the support given by the poles makes the activity feel easier. Nordic walking is a specific fitness technique, which is not to be confused with trekking, hill walking, or trail running, as the poles are not placed in front of the walker, but to the sides, in a way that increases the use of the upper body. It is the fastest growing fitness activity in the world, and it is highly effective, very affordable, and most of all, an enjoyable and sociable activity. However, the technique must be learnt correctly if the participant is to get the most out of the activity, and this is taught by qualified instructors who have undertaken an officially recognised course. The idea of Nordic walking as a sport began when competitive cross-country skiers in Finland started to use ski poles in their off-season training, which included running and walking when there was no snow. They soon realised that the technique was a perfect training aid that kept their hearts and lungs in peak condition, and that upper and lower body muscles remained in top shape. Over the next 50 years, this summer activity began to be used by more people in Finland as a recreational sport, and enthusiasts realised that they were achieving a whole body workout that was simple to incorporate into everyday life. Towards the end of the 20th century, the Finnish Sports Institute joined forces with other agencies and a leading ski pole manufacturer to formalise the technique of the new sport and to develop specific poles for Nordic walkers. Research into the effects of this simple technique soon led to it being trialled as a health and rehabilitation technique. The results were so impressive that it became a major tool in health and wellness programs worldwide. Nordic walking rapidly became a mainstream activity, and there are now well over 10 million regular Nordic walkers globally who enjoy this outdoor activity all year round. A few years ago, the World Nordic Walking Federation was formed to promote safe Nordic walking to communities worldwide whose focus is on accessibility and raising the standards of education of the lead walkers. Conferences have been organised to help bridge the gap between the medical profession and the fitness industry. Specialists are now launching children's fitness courses, which will enable instructors to deliver the technique safely to youngsters. Compared to ordinary walking, Nordic walking involves applying force to the poles with each stride. Thus, the upper and lower body are toned at the same time, and 90% of the skeletal muscles are made to work. The use of poles reduces the pressure and impact on joints and strengthens back and abdominal muscles. The technique helps reduce tensions in the neck and shoulders, while the upper body movement improves posture and the way you walk. This is particularly beneficial to those who have a sedentary lifestyle. It burns up to 46% more calories than ordinary walking. If you would like to lose a few pounds, then Nordic walking is an enjoyable way to do this. It is one of the most effective cross-training techniques for athletes and sports people who require the ultimate cardiovascular and endurance conditioning, as it improves their aerobic capacity and muscular strength in a short period of time. Nordic walking is unique in that it provides benefits for everybody from those with medical problems to the super fit. It is ideal for people who have not exercised for a long time or who dislike traditional sports or gym activities. An injured person can use the poles to support and guide, working to improve fitness as part of their rehabilitation. Athletes can use the technique for cross-country training and can incorporate Nordic walking into their program. Community groups find it a sociable way to keep fit. Whatever your fitness level, age, or goal, this technique is enjoyable for all. The activity can be done anywhere. A street pavement is just as effective a surface as a grassy slope. A sandy beach will provide an excellent opportunity for a full body workout. All you do is adapt the tips of the poles for whatever surface you are walking on. Rubber for hard, smooth surfaces, and a toughened metal tip for trails, beach, and ice. Nordic walking combines exercise with nature, which is thought to boost mood far more effectively than a session in the gym. Hey, try it!
That is the end of the test. Please wait for your question booklet to be collected. Thank you and good luck.